The trial of Karen Reed for the death of her boyfriend, John O'Keefe, is underway.
There are 17 jurors, and they are coming and going with a police escort.
I've seen a lot of things. I've never seen anything like this. This case never ceases to amaze me.
The first week of testimony has come to an end.
It's a spectacle, that's for sure.
We really heard the defense highlight some of the discrepancies between what was documented and what first responders said they remembered.
There are a lot of issues in this case.
Proctor was improperly searching Karen Reed's cell phone for nude photos.
The fact that the investigation wasn't thorough provides a big wrinkle in the prosecution's case.
They're supposed to be creating this reasonable doubt, and they're doing exactly that.
Everybody wants to know, us included, why he wouldn't go inside that home on the night that the body was discovered.
There are more people here at the beginning of this than at the beginning of Johnny Depp's trial.
The theories are stories that each side will put forth, right, for a jury to listen to and decide which one is more believable.
We asked Karen Reed about that alleged confession.
Karen, did you ever say I hit him?
I did not.
The FBI is investigating an investigation of a murder. That never, ever happens.
Karen Reed was drunk and angry and hit and killed John O'Keefe when she gunned it in the snowstorm.
We're looking at arm injuries with scratches. We're not looking at tire tracks.
I did not kill John O'Keefe. I've never harmed a hair on John O'Keefe's head.
Defense attorneys learn in school, first class, the most important thing you can do is identify and select stupid juries.
We're not concerned about any of the witnesses. None of the Commonwealth's witnesses are concerning us.
Karen Reed is facing up to life in prison.
I just hope justice is served for either one, whatever it is, you know?
The fate of her life is not in her hands anymore. It's not in the hands of her attorneys. It's not in the hands of the prosecutor. It's in the hands of the jury now.
Free Karen Reed! Free Karen Reed! Free Karen Reed! Free Karen Reed! Free Karen Reed!
Week one in the murder trial of Karen Reed is now over, and 10 out of 12 witnesses called were first responders from Canton Police Department and Canton Fire Department. One by one, each witness took the stand to give their accounts of what happened that morning when they responded to the scene at 34 Fairview. We hear about the snowy weather, the condition of Officer O'Keefe upon arrival, and about a distraught Karen Reed, hysterical and pacing around the scene, screaming, "Is he dead?" But that's not all the responders testified to Karen saying at the scene in her emotional utterances. Opposing recollections have dominated discussions this week, and just like everything else in this case, we are left with more questions than answers. But before we get into that, I want to talk about the first two witnesses. John's younger brother, Paul, followed by his wife, Erin. Paul O'Keefe is the first witness called by the prosecution, and through his testimony, we're given some more insight into John and into his relationship with Karen Reed. Paul gives some background on his family, including his wife and children and siblings and parents, and we hear about John.
After my sister had passed away in 2013, her husband passed away 2 months after that. My brother he took on responsibility of raising our niece and nephew. He stepped in, moved into the house in Canton and raised them for 8 years.
Hearing Paul get choked up on the stand was incredibly difficult. He's now lost both of his siblings, and hearing the way that he talked about John was touching, but it was emotional. He tells us a little bit about his brother's relationship with Karen Reed as well, and when they reconnected. He said that Karen lived in Mansfield, but would stay at John's with him and the kids about 3 or 4 nights per week, helping with the kids in their school.
Schools were closed and kids had to do remote learning. So Kaylee and Patrick were both at home, remote learning. And my brother, didn't have a job where he can work remote, so he had to go into the office. And most of the time, Karen would be at home with the kids during the day.
Paul says that John and Karen would argue sometimes, but he mostly kept that to himself. He said that John didn't like Karen spending so much money on the kids. He didn't want her to spoil them. And there were occasional arguments that he referred to as typical couples fighting. And he gave an example of a verbal argument in Cape Cod where they had both been drinking. Overall, Paul really liked Karen. He explained that relationship to ADA Lally.
Now, as far as your relationship with the defendant, Ms. Reed, prior to January 29th, 2022, how would you characterize it?
I thought we had a good relationship. I held her in very high regard. I thought she was a good influence on my niece and nephew. I appreciated all the help that she was providing to my brother with the kids. We'd go out together as, you know, couples, a couple times. She was became very friendly with my wife, but I'd say overall we had a good relationship.
Paul said he also told Karen's dad this.
Christmas Eve of 2021 was the first time I met her parents. My brother hosted Christmas Eve at his house. I met Mr. and Mrs. Reed. I offered to help Ms. Reed and Mrs. Reed carry some things in from her car. And as we were walking to the car, I said, you know, I just want to tell you, I think your daughter's great. I think very appreciative of what she's done for the kids and helping my brother.
Paul goes on to describe the morning of January 29th. He said he woke up at 6:40 a.m. when his mom called to let him know that John had been found in the snow and taken to the hospital at Good Samaritan. During Aaron's testimony, she recalled this conversation, saying that she woke up to Paul on the phone with his mom, saying, "He's going to be okay." He hung up and left for the hospital within 10 minutes. Carrie Roberts picked up Mr. and Mrs. O'Keefe and drove them to the hospital, and Paul met them there. They were in the emergency room waiting area when a doctor came in to give them the devastating news that John had passed. The doctor asked the family if they wanted to see him, so they walked through the doors to the emergency room hallway. Paul said on the way to John's room, they saw Karen Reed.
What, if anything, occurred along the way?
So I noticed Karen Reed was there. She was being restrained by hospital employees, and she was, screaming out to us, asking if he was alive.
Is that something that she screamed out once, more than once, or something else?
Several times.
They continued on to John's room, and Paul gets choked up on the stand as he describes the injuries that he saw on his brother.
I mean, he was pretty banged up. He had his eyes had swelled up. He had a breathing tube in, or the mask anyway. Blood come down his nose, blood come down his mouth. But what really stood out to me was, you know, the eyes. It was almost as if like there were ping pong balls under his eyelids. They were that swollen.
The family spent about 20 minutes in the room with John before leaving. And on the way out, he described seeing Karen Reed again.
As you exit the room where your brother is and you come back out in the hallway, what, if anything, occurred at that point?
Again, we saw Karen Reed being restrained by hospital employees saying, screaming the same things. Is he alive? Is he alive? Is he alive?
At any point, either before or after, respond to any of that screaming that you heard from the defendant?
I actually blew her a kiss.
Paul said that at some point, Karen's dad came to the hospital to get her, but he said that they didn't talk while he was there. The family headed to John's house. Paul drove his mom, and Carrie Roberts drove Mr. O'Keefe. The road conditions had greatly deteriorated at that point, and Paul said that he had difficulty driving. They arrived at John's sometime around mid-morning. He estimated between 10 and 11. Michael Camerano, who had come to pick up Kaylee, dropped her back off. Paul said that this is when they had to give her the news that John had passed. I can't imagine the loss that this family has experienced, and how difficult it must have been to tell the children that John had passed, especially after losing their mom and dad. Paul said that Karen called shortly after this and asked to come by and wanted to see the kids. She arrived about 30 minutes later with her dad, while Paul was outside shoveling snow. He says he went inside shortly after they arrived and they all congregated in the kitchen. Shortly after that, John and Paul's nephew, Patrick, who had been at a sleepover, arrived home. Paul said that they moved to a side room in the house where the kids usually hang out, and Karen was with him as he gave the news to Patrick of John's tragic passing. Shortly after this conversation, everyone moved back to the kitchen together. Paul said that Karen and her brother went upstairs and were up there for about 10 to 15 minutes. He was on the phone when he saw them come back down. Karen had gathered some of her belongings from the bedroom, and she left with her family. Paul said there wasn't a lot of interaction with the Reeds while they were there before they headed back to her parents' house in Dighton, taking her bag of belongings and her car that had been left in the driveway that morning. Lally introduces some Ring videos into evidence, and we see the cars in the driveway as the family arrives from the hospital. We see Paul shoveling the driveway, Karen Reed and her family arriving, and Patrick getting dropped off from the sleepover. Paul's testimony ends with Lally showing a picture of John in his 1971 Ford LTD convertible. Paul said that John enjoyed this car. He liked driving it around. And in a touching moment, he explains how his niece and nephew felt about it as well.
Nephew Patrick enjoyed, you know, being driven to baseball games and whatnot. And it's so.
And your niece, Kaylee, how did she feel about it?
She did not like it. Still doesn't.
David Yannetti says he has no questions for Paul, and that concludes his testimony. Paul's wife, Erin, is the next to take the stand. She says that when Paul's sister passed away, she expected that they would be the ones to take the kids, but she said that John stepped in and said, "Nope, I'm going to take them." Erin said that she and Karen met in June of 2020, a few months after she and John had started dating. She said that Karen would stay at John's most days, but would go to her house in Mansfield a few days during the week. When asked to describe her relationship with Karen, she said this.
I liked her a lot.
As far as prior to January 29th of 2022, would you consider yourself or characterize your relationship as friends?
I would.
Erin said that she and Karen talked regularly. She would often talk to her on her commute when she was driving, and they were both excited about how well they got along. When she was asked about fights between Karen and John, Erin said that their arguments seemed like normal relationship fights, stuff that everyone goes through. While in Aruba, Erin said that Karen sent her a text saying that she caught John kissing Laura's sister in the lobby of the hotel and they got into a big argument over it. 4 weeks later, on January 28th, Erin said that she was waiting on her daughter to get off the bus when she got a text from Karen asking if there's any chance that she was out without Paul. She said this isn't a typical text. It sounds like she may have been hoping to talk to Erin without Paul around. Erin asked if everything was okay.
I asked her if everything was okay, if something was up, and she responded and said, "Just another day. I wish I didn't talk to an O'Keefe after 2004.
And how did you respond to that, if you recall?
I said, "What happened? What's going on?" And they had bickered, I guess, about her taking Kaylee to Dunkin' Donuts in the morning before school.
And just to be clear, when you say they, you mean Johnny O'Keefe and Karen?
Correct.
Erin said that she and Paul were watching Yellowstone, and then they went to bed around midnight. She woke up the next morning when Paul was on the phone with his mom. When Paul left for the hospital, Erin was worried about Karen. She said that she called to check on her.
And I called her, and I could hear the phone pick up, and she didn't say hello. I just said, "Karen, what the hell is going on?" And she just yelled back in the phone, "John's dead." And Kerry Roberts grabbed the phone from her and said, "No, he's not. He's at the hospital. They're working on him." And I didn't know what was going on.
Erin said that Kerry Roberts had Karen in her car waiting for the ambulance to pick her up before she went and picked up the O'Keefes. Erin gave her number to Kerry and asked her to keep her updated, and she said that she called or texted Kerry about every 5 minutes for updates. Finally, Kerry called her after they spoke to the doctors. Erin called Karen again around 1 p.m., and she answered, saying that she was on the way to her parents' house in Dighton. She told Erin that the night before they had been out and she dropped John off at a party. She didn't feel like going, so she went back to John's. When she woke up at 4:30, John wasn't home, so she woke up Kaylee to see if she had heard from him.
She said that she went to go out and look, but the roads were bad, so went back and called Kerry and Jen so that they could drive together.
Erin's testimony ends with some of the last things that Karen said to her.
She told me that she had to remember the bad times, which struck me as an odd comment to say, but I assumed since she was at the hospital that maybe she was medicated, but it just struck me as something odd.
What, if anything else, did she say to you at that point during that phone call?
She said, "I don't think I'm ever going to see you guys again." And I said, "Of course you will. We're friends."
Did you ever speak with the defendant, Karen Reed, again?
No.
David Unetti chose not to do any cross-examination on Erin O'Keefe. So we are going to move right into the testimony from the first responders right after this break. The first responders have dominated the majority of the first 6 days of trial. But if you thought that this was going to be the testimony that clears everything up, think again.
It's like, if we've learned anything from these first responders and these cops, it's that nothing was clear. We have heard so many different versions of this story just with the first responders that we've talked to.
The prosecution has accomplished not just gaining ground, not just not gaining ground, they have lost ground during their case in chief. During their case in chief, where they're supposed to be presenting their strongest evidence, you always put on your strongest witness first, the witness that has the most to offer. Right?
I'm angry that none of these witnesses seem to give a shit enough about this victim to do their job. I'm so mad. This victim deserves better. How is this how you treat a victim who is not just a local police officer, but as described by paramedics, a local hero?
The only thing that has been consistent throughout testimony of every first responder so far is that the scene in the yard at 34 Fairview was chaotic. One by one, each first responder from the Canton Fire Department and Canton Police Department took the stand to give testimony on their recollection of what happened in those early morning hours. As Assistant District Attorney Adam Lally walked each witness through their testimony, the defense team took notes, comparing their memory of that day to their previous reports and grand jury testimony, and calling out every conflicting statement. There are a lot of names here, and I know that it can get kind of confusing, so rather than go through each witness individually, I want to instead walk through the scene, bringing in the testimony from each as we go. Then we'll break down the defense's cross-examinations of each hole that they were able to poke in some of the testimony. The first 911 call came in from Carrie Roberts, and Sergeant Sean Good was working dispatch. The audio isn't great, but we hear Carrie say that she's calling because her friend's boyfriend didn't come home last night. She says that they were at Waterfall, and now she's hysterical because she doesn't know where he is. When she left, she expected him to come home at some point, and he never did. Carrie asks if they picked anyone up by the name of John O'Keefe, and tells him that he's a Boston cop and where he lives. Good says that they didn't and wishes her luck. An hour later, at 6:04 a.m., he receives another 911 call, this time from Jen McCabe at 34 Fairview.
911, you're
Jen. Immediately and start
filming a new girl,
Jen, now. What's going on? This is
high on
Chocolate Lane.
Okay,
you
got
it. Okay, this
is Chocolate
Lane. Yeah, so for the hour residence. Yeah, I just pulled up the office.
It's worth noting that all of the times that Jen was transferred, she gave the correct address every time, and she also said it's the Albert residence. But the reports still had the wrong address. The first on the scene is Canton Police Officer Steven Seraf. Now, I have to admit a mistake here. For the last 8 or 9 months on this podcast, I've been referring to him, like I just said, as Seraf. One of the drawbacks of going through nonstop court documents as opposed to watching other people's coverage is that sometimes you pronounce things wrong. So apparently it's Seraf. So Officer Seraf, if you're out there listening, My bad. When the call came in, Sheriff was parked in a lot nearby, so it didn't take him long to get there. He turned onto Fairview and used his spotlight to look for the address through the snow. When he got to the house, he saw the three women waving him down, and he said he could see John O'Keefe on the ground. He pulled his cruiser behind where Carrie Roberts was parked, which was close to where Officer O'Keefe was found. Through his dash cam, we hear audio of a hysterical Karen Reed. Attorney Alan Jackson played this audio in court, and while it's not easy to hear, he says you can clearly hear Karen screaming, "My boyfriend, I left him and he never came home." Sheriff said John's body was to the left of the property by the flagpole. All responders confirmed this in their testimony, though each has a varying estimate of how far back he was. That's not surprising since by this point there was snow on the ground and it isn't easy to see where the curb was. Sheriff said that Karen was hysterical, crying that this was her fault, that she did this, screaming, "Is he dead?" repeatedly with blood on her face from trying to give John CPR. Just a minute or two after Sheriff arrives, Officer Stephen Mullaney pulls up, coming from the opposite direction on Fairview, heading south, and at about the same time, first on the scene from the fire department arrives in an ambulance from the other direction traveling north, pulling up behind Sheriff's cruiser, as close as they're able to so that they can get to John as fast as possible while carrying their equipment. Anthony Flametti, Matthew Kelly, Timothy Nuttall jump out of the ambulance to assist John. A fire engine arrives with firefighters Katie McLaughlin, Frank Walsh, and Lieutenant Greg Woodbury. All of these responders arrive nearly back-to-back within just a few minutes, starting at 6:09 a.m. Karen Reed is still distraught and hysterical, screaming and pacing around the area. When the rescue team arrived to John, he wasn't breathing and he didn't have a pulse. Kelly testified to doing compressions. Nuttall said that he was going to have to ventilate John. Walsh, Woodbury, and Katie McLaughlin are in the engine where they retrieve a stretcher and take it toward John. Mullaney assists Nuttall, Flamati, and Robery with getting John onto a scoop so that they can lift him onto the stretcher. Dashcam video shows John being lifted onto the stretcher at 6:14, only 3 minutes after the ambulance arrived on scene. They lift the stretcher onto the ambulance with Nuttall, Kelly, and Flamati in the back with him. During this three-minute time frame, the responders all testified about what they witnessed with Karen. Every witness said that she was hysterical and distraught, screaming, though there's some debate about what they heard her screaming. Mullaney recalls Karen screaming, "Is that my boyfriend? Is he dead?" repeatedly, which is consistent with his statement in the report. Nuttall, who arrived in the ambulance, said that he remembers there being a period of time where he was getting equipment and he asked Karen what happened and that she replied, "I hit him." And Flamati said that he had a conversation in this three-minute time frame with Karen also when he was trying to get information as he was bringing equipment over to John. He said that he asked her what happened and she responded with, "I hit him." Kelly remembers differently. He remembers Karen screaming, "He's dead. He's fucking dead." And Kelly's recollection of this is backed up by not only dash cam, but all four officer statements from the police report, as well as the testimony of Walsh and Woodbury last week. The other testimony, and probably one of the most controversial from the week of trial, is Katie McLaughlin. Katie's testimony began toward the end of day three, and she's describing her recollection of the events. She said that Karen was distraught, moving around the scene. She couldn't be still, so Katie was just kind of following her. When she delivers the next part, it seems almost scripted. Dramatic pause and all.
She answered who the patient was, his birthday. I think she answered the maybe some of those initial medical questions that I asked. She's very distraught. She was kind of moving around the scene a little bit. So I was like just kind of following her, and then we came to a stop at one point, and I continued to ask one more question.
What was that one more question?
So at that point, I asked her if there had been any significant trauma that happened before this.
What, if anything, did she say?
So she said, "I hit him." She repeated it. There was a woman standing across from her who I believe at that point said, you're hysterical. You need to calm down. You're hysterical. She repeated, I hit him. And there was a police officer who was in that vicinity kind of with us who replied, you what? She repeated it one more time. And that officer then signaled to somebody, get Goody down here, which I'm assuming would be the sergeant.
We know that the time frame Katie is talking about is when John had been put in the back of the ambulance. Katie said when this conversation happened, she was standing with Karen to her right, a woman to her left, and an officer diagonal to her, closer to Karen. Katie said that she didn't know the officer's name, but we can see in the dash cam video that the officer that she's talking about is Seraph, standing right next to Karen, facing her. Katie said after this happened, she went and got in the ambulance, and she told Flamati and Nuttall about Karen saying, I hit him. This is a big debate in court this week, so let's break this down. In all of the testimony and reports from Seraph, Mulaney, Kelly, Walsh, Woodbury, Good, and later Becker and Whitley, which we'll get to shortly, they all testified, both on the stand and in reports, that Karen was hysterically screaming or yelling some version of, is he dead? And we also hear the dash cam of Karen screaming this in the background. So every single one of these testimonies and reports corroborate each other. Katie McLaughlin, Anthony Flamati, and Timothy Nuttall were the only ones who testified to hearing Karen say, I hit him. Katie said that Karen said this while they were standing in that group that she described. So if they were in the group, then those testimonies should also corroborate Katie, right? But not in this case. Both statements from the other two individuals in that group contradict what Katie said. Seraph was standing right in front of Karen and testified that he didn't hear her say, I hit him. The other female that Katie mentioned in the group testified to Karen saying, could I have hit him? Did I hit him? But said that that was it. She never said, I hit him. There has been some controversy over Katie, her testimony, and her friendship with Caitlin Albert, which has sparked a lot of conversation on whether or not she misheard this statement or if she's not being truthful. That's a little more in depth and a little crazy, so we're going to get to that in just a minute. But first, I want to talk about Flamati and Nuttall for a moment. Both of these young men came off as very credible and smart, honest, and forthcoming. Nothing about their testimony struck me as misleading. However, there were some inconsistencies, but I think that they can be easily explained. During the time when Katie said that she heard Karen say, I hit him in the group in front of Seraph, both Nuttall and Flamati were both in the ambulance with the doors closed, and they would not have heard Karen say that if she had said that in that group. If it was said during that 3-minute period before John was in the ambulance, it would mean that all of the other responders on scene, Seraph, Mulaney, Kelly, Walsh, Woodbury, and Good, plus Carrie and Jen, somehow missed her screaming this. So if nobody else corroborated Katie's statement about Karen saying, I hit him, then why would they? Nuttall and Flamati wouldn't risk their careers and potential jail time for perjury just to try to convince a jury that some woman that they don't even know should be convicted. So here's where memory and perception come into play. It struck me that in her statement, Katie McLaughlin said that after Karen said, I hit him in the group, she walked over to the ambulance and told Nuttall and Flamati this, who happened to be the other two who testified to hearing this. Nuttall also testified that this case and the events of that morning have been a regular topic of conversation at the firehouse since it happened, and it's talked about often. Those two factors can play a huge role in memory, and here's why. First, it is a well-documented fact that witnesses are susceptible to post-event misinformation. This is a cognitive psychological effect, and this is where a witness can develop a false memory by integrating information from an outside source. Creating these false memories based on post-event misinformation is especially common in high-stress situations, like trying to save a life. So if her report is right and Katie went and told these two guys that Karen said that, That could be a source of post-event misinformation, something that they didn't necessarily experience, but it is incorporated into their memory. The second factor is talking about this at the firehouse. Let's say that each person is sitting around talking about the case or that morning or reliving the events, and each person is sharing their recollection. Research has shown that social interactions like this can distort a person's memory, specifically what they claim to remember about the same event. As they're sitting around talking about it, their brains can be integrating the new information and perspectives that they're hearing of that event into their own memory. Crazy, right? Now, do we know for a fact that this is what happened? No, of course not. But it's a very simple and logical way to explain the conflicting stories from what appear to be really credible and honest witnesses. Which brings us to Katie McLaughlin. I like to remind listeners that all people that we report on are considered to be innocent of any and all allegations unless proven otherwise. With Katie, the defense has accused her of perjury. We know that Caitlin Albert, the daughter of the homeowners of 34 Fairview, and Katie have known each other since high school. They played sports together. There are pictures of them in their friend group for school dances and other get-togethers. We've seen pictures of Katie and Caitlin together on some sort of beach vacation or day trip in 2016, and people have even posted that they're Venmo friends. With Nuttall and Flametti, the cross-examination focused on showing that they were in the ambulance and couldn't have heard what they remembered hearing, and pointed to other faulty memories of that morning. But with Katie, it went beyond just pointing out that the other individuals in the group contradicted her statement. They brought up her relationship with Caitlin Albert.
Ms. McLaughlin, who's Caitlin Albert?
I went to high school with somebody named Caitlin Albert.
With somebody named Caitlin Albert?
I went to high school with somebody named Caitlin Albert.
So do you know Caitlin Albert?
I do.
You friends with Caitlin Albert?
I would say more acquaintances, not close friends.
How do you describe an acquaintance?
I would say that we have mutual friends, so we might see each other occasionally because of mutual friends, but we don't have a one-on-one friendship or hang out regularly.
I went to high school with someone named Caitlin Albert. Now, to be fair, when this was going on last week, I looked at my Venmo friends list, and there are people that I haven't talked to in years that I wasn't even close to start with. And the pictures that were shown were from 2016, though Katie said that she didn't remember when they were from or where they were taken. So the evidence presented to show their relationship by no means shows that they're walking around Canton with best friend forever bracelets, but it does show an obvious connection. By answering in such an evasive way, it came across as intentionally misleading or trying to distance herself from Caitlin. I think that this would have gone over a lot better if she had just started this with, "Yeah, we have mutual friends. We know each other, but we aren't close." During the line of questioning, Katie tells Jackson that she can't recall the last time that she talked to Caitlin. She can't recall if she has ever been to her house, can't recall when or where those pictures were taken, and said that she doesn't know Caitlin's family. Jackson wanted to make sure that the jury knows that there's a connection here, but Katie insisted that the pictures are old and she hasn't seen Caitlin recently. So one thing about the internet, sleuths are gonna sleuth. Over the weekend, suddenly everyone who ever had a picture of Katie and Caitlin together shows up, and a bunch of pictures were sent to the defense team, including one of Katie and Caitlin at a baby shower in June of 2021, which was about 6 or 7 months before John O'Keefe's death. The defense says that this suggests a deeper relationship than what Katie testified to, and they want to enter this as evidence to impeach her. The judge will rule on that request this week. So, like everything else in this case, nobody agrees on what the most likely scenario is. Did Karen say, "I hit him," as a confession that three of the responders heard? Or was it a question? Could I have hit him? Is Katie changing the wording of what was said in her testimony to help stack the evidence against Karen as a favor for her friend's dad? Or is it some version in between? Will we ever know the answer to that? We'll be right back. Going back to the scene, John O'Keefe is in the ambulance, about to be transported to Good Samaritan Hospital. With him in the ambulance are Kelly, Nuttall, and Flamati in the back, and Katie McLaughlin driving. Soon after John is put into the ambulance, Sergeant Good arrives on scene. According to his dash cam, he arrives at 6:16 a.m. Now, what's interesting about Sergeant Good coming is that he was working dispatch at the time. He's actually the one who received the 911 calls. He called in coverage for dispatch so that he could respond to Fairview himself, and he called Lieutenant Gallagher and Sergeant Lank to let them know as well. He said that Gallagher was coming off the shift, and Lank is in charge of the detectives, so he wanted to inform both of them. Good said the same thing that everyone else has, that Karen was hysterical, confused, and kept screaming, "Is he dead?" When John is wheeled away on the stretcher, we can see dashcam video of Carrie Roberts walking over to where he had been. She bends down and picks up a towel or blanket, and she shakes it off, then walks over to put it in the back of her car. She closes the tailgate of her SUV and then begins cleaning the snow off of her rear window. Now, one thing that has always bugged me, and I brought it up before, is knowing who had John's phone. In one of the reports, we hear that Proctor responded to the scene to secure it, but we know that he wasn't at 34 Fairview, which is what we would logically think of as the scene. Apparently, in that sentence, they were referring to the scene as the police station. Regardless, someone had to have gotten the phone from the scene, the actual scene, that day, and it's always been a controversial topic when trying to figure out who. There are no GPS data points that show movement on John's phone after 12:25 a.m. until 6:15 a.m., which is the exact time, pretty much to the second, that Carrie is seen on that dash cam video walking over to her car after bending over to pick up the towel or the blanket. The only officers on the scene at that time were Serif and Mullaney, and both of them are seen on different parts of the dash cam, not by where John was found. I think that it would make sense that Carrie picked up John's phone if it was on the ground right there at the same time that she was picking up the blanket. There are steps recorded on the phone pretty continuously from that time until almost 8:30 a.m., so we know that she didn't put the phone in her car. She left with Karen just before 6:30, and the phone was recording steps at that time, so if she handed it off before she left with Karen, then it would have gone to Serif, Mullaney, Good, or Lank. But none of them testified to it, so it's still one of those unanswered questions. For now, anyway. John was in the ambulance for somewhere around 10 minutes before they actually left to take him to the hospital. The first responders testified that while in the ambulance, John's clothing was removed with trauma shears in order to assess his injuries. Firefighter Kelly testified that some of the removed clothing will stay on the stretcher with the patient and some on the ambulance floor, and when they arrive at the hospital, the clothing is then transferred to a nurse. Nuttall testified that the clothing was brought into the hospital and deposited on the floor of the room where the patient is, with the hospital then taking possession of it. The clothing is something that each responder was asked to describe. There were a few inconsistencies, which isn't uncommon when testifying about details that happened more than 2 years ago. Nuttall remembered a heavy winter jacket being a part of what they cut off, for example. But overall, the memories on the clothing were pretty consistent. John was missing one shoe, he had on a hoodie with a t-shirt underneath, and he was wearing jeans. After removing his clothing, the responders were able to assess his injuries. John's arm injuries were described as scratches or furrows by Nuttall. Kelly and Flamati both described them as lacerations, but Flamati pointed out that they weren't actively bleeding. Lally asked him to explain this.
And we had multiple dry blood lacerations to the right arm.
You recall specifically where on Mr. O'Keefe's right arm?
It would have been his upper arm.
And you mentioned dry blood, is that correct?
Yes.
So these were not actively bleeding at the time that you observed them?
No.
Now, as far as being dry blood versus actively bleeding, what, if anything, does that indicate to you as far as sort of timing?
So we had active bleeding from other areas in the body. So the fact that it had already stopped and clotted, I would assume that would have been several hours before the incident that led him to be there, but I would guess earlier in the evening.
This detail made me stop in my tracks. He just said that since John's arm injuries weren't actively bleeding anymore, those injuries likely happened earlier in the night, before whatever caused him to be outside. If the jury picked up on that, that's a huge win for the defense, since their theory is that those injuries are from the Albert's dog jumping in as a result of the fight. Walsh said he saw scratches and lacerations on John's arm as well, and the responders all discussed the signs of hypothermia, the cut or laceration above John's eye, and the swelling in his eyes. The ambulance pulled away from the scene at 6:27 a.m., according to the responder logs, arriving at Good Samaritan Hospital at 6:45. While John is in the ambulance, Karen remained hysterical. Seraph said that he tried to get her out of the elements and put her in a cruiser, but she only stayed for a few minutes. Then she was up and down, in and out of the cruiser. Good attempted to speak to her briefly, and he asked her if she drove there. He said that she answered, "I think so, I don't remember," but he stopped questioning her because she couldn't keep her train of thought. One of the most crucial pieces of evidence in this whole trial is the 2:27 a.m. Google search for how long to die in the cold. The morning searches happened at 6:23 and 6:24 a.m., and Jen McCabe said that she searched this because Karen yelled at her to. One statement reads that Karen and Jen prayed "Our Father" together, then Karen immediately yelled at her twice to Google how long do you have to be left outside to die from hypothermia. At the time that this search happened, Seraph, Mulaney, and Good were all there, as well as some of the first responders from the fire department. I was hoping that this is something that could be possibly cleared up at this point also, if there were dash cam video to corroborate this, or if any of the other people on scene heard her screaming this. But none of the dash cam video that was played showed this, and nobody testified to hearing it.
At one point, you saw Karen Reed being escorted into a motor vehicle?
Yes.
And that was one of the women on scene, her motor vehicle?
Yes, it was either that or a cruiser.
All right.
Both kind of the same area.
But you'll agree with me, at no point in time did you see Karen Reed and Jennifer McCabe in a vehicle together?
Not that I recall, no.
And at no point in time did you ever hear Karen Reed ask Jennifer McCabe to Google anything?
No.
We will hear the testimony eventually from Jen McCabe and Carrie Roberts, plus from the cell phone experts on both sides who will explain why they can prove that the search happened at either 2:27 a.m. or 6:24 a.m. It'll be up to the jury to decide what they believe. With Karen unable to calm down and the ambulance with John already gone, the police told Carrie to go ahead and take Karen home, get her out of there.
Miss Reed just was not listening to any directions. We were trying to keep her in Miss Roberts' car to stay warm. She's going back and forth. I finally told Miss Roberts, we have everybody's information. She's not needed here anymore. Go home, get warm. We'll reach out if we have to.
And shortly after, and at that point, did Ms. Roberts take Ms. Reed?
She did.
And what, if anything, happened next on scene with regard to Ms. Reed?
It was moments later. I got a radio transmission from our officer at the working dispatch that Mr. Reed, her father, was on the phone with Ms. Reed, and she was making suicidal threats to take her own life.
They had barely left the scene when Carrie Roberts pulled back up with Karen after this. Sergeant Good can be heard on dash cam saying that he's going to place a Section 12 hold on her.
So this call was for a Section 12, which is someone in having a psychological issue.
Lieutenant Greg Woodbury from Canton Fire Department had just gone back to the station when he was called back in for this. Daniel Whitley and Jason Becker from Canton Fire were also dispatched for Karen. When the ambulance arrived, Whitley and Becker were in the back of the ambulance with Karen, and these two men testified back to back, but their recollection of these minutes in the ambulance are strikingly different. First, we hear from Whitley.
The initial conversation, she was very upset. She kept saying, So we had a Section 12 written, and that was to take her to the hospital because she made threats against her life, saying, I don't want to live anymore. If my husband dies, I don't want to be alive anymore. And myself and Jason and Lieutenant Woodbury were kind of like, well, that's seemingly more in the lines of normal grieving process after something traumatic happens to a loved one, whether they're going to die or not. We kind of didn't feel like it kind of led to that level of a Section 12 to have her transported to the hospital. So at that point, I exited the ambulance and I went to speak with Officer Sarif, and I said, you know, this kind of doesn't, if we want her to be at the hospital, get a full eval, we're going to need more than just, if my husband dies, I want to die, because that seems just like normal grieving things to say.
He goes on to describe his conversation with Karen.
Yes, she was very upset. She kept asking if there was any chance. She kept asking us if we knew if the person Ambulance One had transported was alive or dead, and we could not speak to that. She asked if somebody could be alive in the snow without a jacket for many hours. And at that point, we were just trying to give her any hope that whomever A1 transported was still alive. And we kind of just talked about far-off hypothermia cases where, you know, kids have fallen in rivers and been submerged for many minutes, maybe even hours, and survived with no neurological deficits. So we were just trying to give her some sort of hope on the way to the hospital that there was a chance that her husband could be alive.
Obviously, we know that Karen and John weren't married, but both Whitley and Becker said that she kept asking about her husband. I'm not sure if this was so that she could get updates on his status or just what she was saying in the moment, but she repeated it several times. Now I want to compare the perception of the conversations that took place in the ambulance in front of Whitley and Becker. When asked about Karen's behavior, this is what Whitley said.
There would be episodes where she would like go from crying in her hands to all of a sudden perking up.
In one of Jen McCabe's statements, she said that Karen would go from being quiet or calm to all of a sudden screaming and yelling. But this is the first time we've heard perk up. And when he did it, he made the expressions with his hand and made the movements like perky. It was the first time we've heard that. Here is how Jason Becker described it.
She would have periods of calmness. And then other periods, she would appear agitated because she didn't want to go to the hospital. But all in all, she was cooperative with us.
There was also a conversation about the kids, John's niece and nephew. This is what Whitley said.
She was crying about having to take care of kids, saying she couldn't do it. And I was saying, you know, you can do this. It's not as hard as it seems. She kept saying, I can't take care of these kids. They're not my kids and they're not his kids.
This was shocking to me. This is the first that I've heard anyone mention anything negative about her as it relates to the kids. John's brother said how appreciative he was of how she stepped in with them. All of the friends that they were at McCarthy's with that night all talked about how they trusted her with the kids and her involvement in their lives. Although it did bother John that she liked to buy them expensive things because he didn't want her to spoil them. But everything that we've heard from everyone up to this point has been the opposite of this. Here's Jason Becker describing that same conversation.
She was unsure and she didn't know if she'd be able to take care of them. She was worried about that.
She was worried about that?
Yeah, she's worried about who would take care of the children if he was Brown's dead. She didn't think that she could take care of him on her own.
The way that Becker describes the conversation is very different. Worrying about the kids and not thinking that she can take care of them on her own is a lot different than saying, I can't take these kids. It would make sense for Karen to worry about being able to take care of the kids alone. Not just because parenting is incredibly difficult, but because Karen has struggled with major health issues for years. She was diagnosed with Crohn's disease when she was only 25, leading to 10 surgeries over a two-year period, and then a major reconstructive surgery on her intestines at Cleveland Clinic. Then, at age 32, Karen faced yet another health challenge when she was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, a chronic, incurable autoimmune disease that affects the brain and spinal cord, slowing or stopping nerve signals. This can cause numbness, exhaustion, pain, bladder problems, muscle weakness, mobility issues, just to name a few. If you were dealing with all of that, wouldn't you be worried about whether or not you were able to do it alone, too? Becker said that Karen was upset because the last time that she talked to John, they had an argument, but she didn't say what about. Yannetti clarifies on cross-examination that Karen didn't say if this was an argument in person or on the phone, since we know that she left him an angry voicemail that evening. He also says that Karen was distraught and crying and said that she didn't mean what she said about her suicidal thoughts. She was just saying it in the moment because she was so overwhelmed from having just given CPR to the man that she referred to as her husband. He also says that Karen kept repeating, could he be dead, and could I have hit him? The difference in perception of the conversations is more than likely something that the jury would have noticed. They'll have to decide on how to take each person's statements. And one part of that they may consider is the connections that Whitley has to Carrie Roberts and John O'Keefe.
And I was saying, well, it seems like you have a good, strong support system, people who came and helped you in a blizzard to help come find your husband. She said, she asked me if I knew Carrie Roberts. I said I did. She said anybody who knows Carrie Roberts wouldn't say those things. And that kind of took me aback a bit. It seemed strange to say something like that after you were just crying because your husband was dead. I was just kind of surprised.
So the tone and tenor, so what can you tell us about that? That's admissible, Mr. Yannetti. Go ahead.
The tone, she would go from being almost despondent to when she asked me if I knew Carrie Roberts, the only tone I can use to describe it is snarky.
Objection. Move to strike.
I'll strike that.
They can strike it, but the jury can't unhear it. As the saying goes, you can't unring that bell. Lally asks Whitley how he knows Carrie.
And how is it that you know Carrie Roberts?
Well, Carrie lives around the corner from me.
How long have you known Carrie Roberts?
Just from moving back into the neighborhood, she would run the neighborhood block party, and she put out that she would like the fire truck there on the neighborhood Facebook page, so I volunteered to bring the fire truck to the neighborhood block party.
And was Ms. Roberts on scene on Fairview when you arrived in your ambulance?
Yes.
So she was one of the other females along with the defendant?
Correct.
Whitley also says that when Karen is talking, that's when he realizes that she's talking about John O'Keefe. Turns out, he also knew John O'Keefe.
I live in and grew up in the Ponk Bog neighborhood of Canton, and Mr. O'Keefe was known for taking on his niece and nephew after, I'm not sure positive of the relationship, but I believe it was his sister and his brother-in-law passed away, and it was something people admired him for, people looked up to him for. I moved into the Ponk Bog neighborhood back after living outside of Canton for a few years. The O'Keefes lived diagonally across from me.
This really is one of those towns where it seems like everyone knows everyone. We've made it through the first week of testimony, hearing from all the first responders. On the next episode, we're going to take a look at the investigation and the night at C.F. McCarthy's in Waterfall. You do not want to miss that episode. It's the only time that I've ever seen an investigation that involved evidence collection in solo cups that were placed in a Stop and Shop bag. I wish I were joking. We're only one week in, and we have a lot left to uncover. My name is Brandy Churchwell, creator of 13th Juror Podcast. If you're enjoying it, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and share this episode with your friends. For more information, photos, and episode guides, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com.